Welcome everyone to this live session at Best Ideas 2022. It is a great pleasure to welcome back to this forum, Christopher Carlin. Chris has been in the investment business since 1991. Chris, congratulations on what's a 30-year anniversary. Prior to founding Aquitania Capital Management in 2012, Chris held positions as a research analyst and portfolio manager at First Pacific Advisors, Kestrel Investment Management, and Fairview Capital Investment Management. Chris interned with Farallon Capital Management while pursuing his MBA. He began his career with Wells Fargo Nico Investment Advisors, which later became a part of BlackRock. Chris received his BBA from the University of Wisconsin in 1990, his MBA from Yale University in 1998, and has held the CFA designation since 1994. And Chris, this has become somewhat of an annual tradition to have you at our event, and I'm very grateful to you for continuing that tradition this year. So without further ado, let's turn it to you for your presentation, and I'll be back for the Q&A. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you, John. And it definitely has become a recurring event and a highlight of my year to be able to present and to be part of this community. It's been fantastic, the number of connections, number of great ideas that have come out of it, and certainly has made me a better investor. Anyways, getting on to the presentation, little disclaimer. Last year at this, I presented British Petroleum. Still like the oil space, I think BP was at about 24, 25 last year, and it's about 32 today. So, decent return there in the mid to high 20s, increasingly positive on oil going forward, and have diversified into, a number of the, lower capitalization names, I think have more upside, but still maintain a position in BP. Getting onto that, just a little bit about my firm. Really, there's three buckets that I'm looking at. I'm looking at investing for maximizing long-term capital appreciation, sort of superior returns without taking speculative risk. And so the three buckets of investment are, should be very familiar to most of the audience. Certainly looking for compounders where we have, long runways and hopefully can find them before they're fully discovered and fully valued. Certainly the opportunistic, which, we're doing more of at the moment, waiting for some of the compounders to come down a bit in price, although many have over the last couple of months. And then the counterweights, because I still can't get comfortable saying macro, but essentially these are, mostly some, commodity businesses, but that I expect to be a long-term, hedge against inflation, whether that be financial services, real estate, minerals, and certainly our oil position falls into that. And with that, I'll get on with today's presentation on Tuesday morning, where you're betting on a proven and a very highly incented management team. Tuesday morning, it's 194, it's trading about 190 at the moment. It's an off-price home goods retailer. It's been operating since 1974. In early 2020, they filed Chapter 11, not because the balance sheet was problematic. They're really, whatever debt was on the balance sheet was paid in full, but they utilized Chapter 11 to restructure their leases, shrank the store base from 687 stores to 490 stores, and at the same time, on the remaining 490 stores, was able to extract significant rent concessions from their landlords. So that's a permanent structural cost advantage that they have going forward. There's a new highly regarded management team that has been in place since May, late May of last year, primarily. Most of the party, most of the management team came from Burlington Stores, where they had a very solid track record of creating value there. They have shifted the business from one that was highly promotional to an everyday off-price, which has saved them on margin, you know, and hopefully stabilizes the traffic flow to not be driven by promotional. And of course, it's also saved them in advertising expense because they don't have to communicate the promotions. Certainly, it is a business where COVID and the restructuring has greatly clouded the external visibility. It is a small cap name. It's $175 million market cap, about $220 million enterprise value, which is actually probably overstating what it is today because that's off the 930 value where the short-term debt had risen as they built up inventory for the calendar fourth quarter sales season. So I would imagine today they should report early February, and you'll probably see as of December 31st that there's less debt on the balance sheet, and they're probably closer to a $200 million enterprise value. There's also $154 million in net operating losses, and that'll probably rise a bit again as they report calendar 2021 results. The value proposition for the firm is it's a treasure hunt destination, similar to Ross Stores, similar to Home Goods, Burlington. The idea is to get the customers in the store. You'll never know what you'll find. But it, should be interesting merchandise, and it should be at a significant discount compared to what you would find at a Macy's or a department store retailer. The stores are relatively small; they're about 12,000 square feet. They're usually in strip malls. They're not in sort of Simon property malls, big malls. They are in strip malls, usually next to a Planet Fitness or a Starbucks or something like that. This is their version of their competitive position, which I think is perhaps a little more favorable than is accurate in terms of putting their quality above Home Goods, TJ Maxx, Marshalls. I think it's actually much more comparable to that. Certainly they there's his branded merchandise, so it's higher than what you would find at like an Ollie's, where it's really the emphasis is on the discount and not so much on the quality. Again, giving a sort of a list of the breakdown of the revenue items. It's housewares, it's crafts. On a store visit that I went to, I came away with a dog toy for my pet. Towels, you can see some of the brands and cookware, things like that. This is a little bit on their customer. It's primarily middle-aged women, middle class, who have the time and the budget to make frequent store visits. And, there's decent customer loyalty. The important thing, even though they went through a bankruptcy, and you could argue this is a turnaround, I would actually take a different view in that, their relationship with their consumer isn't broken. Their sales didn't fall off a cliff. They took advantage of, Chapter 11, very opportunistically to address their store count and their cost structure. You can see where they are. Again, these are the 490 stores that remain, and heavy concentration in the South, in Sun Belt, in states that have growth like North Carolina, Texas, California, Florida, Colorado, Tennessee, Georgia. less in the north. So there's, you know, definitely a they're situated well with their footprint relative to, you know, how the demographics of the country are changing. This was a store visit here in Austin. You can see it's pretty no frills, you know, store and strip mall, all the merchandise is off on the floor. Aisles are clean, you know, but there's nothing's fancy about the presentation. And so just to go over the bankruptcy timeline, you know, in late March of 20, they closed all their stores with the COVID lockdowns. In late May of 20, they filed for Chapter 11. The equity remained trading throughout the bankruptcy. It was not, you know, it came out with a different ticker, but it traded all the way through. So the equity investors kept their stake. You know, at the end of June, they had opened most of their stores, but then in that they're on a June fiscal year. So in their first calendar quarter of, you know, from June to September of, or from July to September of 2020, that's when they actively closed the stores, you know, and then in September, they initially, they did that presentation, which some of the previous slides are from, related to emergence. And that also contained financial projections, which we'll get to a little bit later. You know, because the debts were paid in full, the equity stake was maintained, and it was really a Chapter 11 that was, all the vendors were paid in full. And the Chapter 11 was, again, designed towards addressing the lease costs and the store footprint. And so the financial projections were made in conjunction with, you know, promoting a warrant offering. And so, you know, there was no need to sandbag those financial projections. And we'll get to that again a little bit later. The plan was confirmed at the end of December of 20. They emerged at the end of the year. They got a $25 million pay-in-kind term loan from the hedge funds Osbien and Tensile out in the Bay Area. And they'd February, they closed a rights offering with those same firms, who now have a 31% equity stake in Tuesday morning. Getting on to the management team. So prior to the bankruptcy in December of 19, Paul Metcalf was brought on as an acting chief merchant. He was a consultant. His background was at Burlington Stores and, you know, TJX, so Home Goods, and TJ Maxx. In May of 2021, after the emergence from bankruptcy, it's about, you know, 5 months after the emergence of bankruptcy, you know, they brought in Fred Hand as the CEO. He had previously been COO at Burlington Stores. He, in turn, later that month, brought in Mark Katz as at the time a CFO, who had previously been the CFO at Burlington Stores. Then in September, Katz becomes COO. They bring in a woman who had been in the Treasury Department at Michaels in as CFO. They brought in a chief information officer with extensive retail experience. And then in late September, Paul Metcalf becomes a full-time employee as chief merchant officer. And so here's the opportunity. You can see this is a trading over the last year since emergence. And these first two, you know, upticks in May are in conjunction with the announcement of the new CEO, the new CFO. And then you see the big drawdown in September. And, you know, what happened there is that they came out for the for their first quarter of the new management team, and they basically, you know, suspended the guidance that had been in the financial projections that they didn't have a role in, and guided you know, towards a basically suspended all expectations going forward, primarily because of supply chain issues, which in their case are mostly transportation, and some increased labor costs. So these were the initial projections that were given, and the projections were for about, you know, $48 million in adjusted EBITDA for the fiscal 22, which ends June of this year. And they essentially guided it down, you know, to a loss and being cash flow neutral. As you can see, they reset the expectations pretty sufficiently. That caused a the air to go out of the stock, clearly and understandably. And you know, they haven't been they've been doing what you would want your management team to do. They've been, you know, working on optimizing the business and not on communicating with investors. And you know, that that sometimes creates a vacuum in the stock. So the question is, you know, what is an appropriate estimate of normalized earnings for this business? So again, you know, just to summarize, they went to an EBITDA forecast for fiscal 22 ending this June of a loss of $20 million, which is in line with fiscal 21 performance, versus the financial projections, which were for a positive $48 million. Free cash flow went down about zero versus, you know, maybe about $38 million in expected positive cash flow. Now, there's a couple things to keep in mind. One is the new team did not make these projections. Second is, you know, October of 21. October of 21, you know, very different. October of 20 was when those projections first came out. And that's a very different COVID environment than what they were facing in the fall of last year. You know, this was right. The projections were made with the expectation the vaccine was on the way and this would all sort of blow over and we'd be back to normal. And obviously we know that that didn't happen. We had, you know, the Delta wave last summer and then currently the Omicron wave, which, you know, we'll again get to a little bit. But the issue going back to what is normalized earnings, you have to say, well, you know, was the $48 million projection reasonable? And I would argue that it largely was because it relied on structural cost savings, which have already been implemented. Rent, you know, you can see creates a run rate savings of about $12 million on the remaining store base. They had two distribution centers, one in Dallas where they're headquartered and one in Phoenix. They closed the Phoenix one. That's another $12 million in savings. And then the overhead costs in advertising, sales districts, all that, another 70. So you had about $40 million in run rate savings that are structurally locked in. So again, it gets to the question, like what's causing the problem? And here you can see, you know, the biggest portion was expected to come from rent, from the distribution center, going from, you know, 1.9%, you know, adjusted EBITDA margin in fiscal 2019 to, you know, a projected of a margin of 6.7%. And so the question is, why didn't they get there if, you know, the rent is locked in, the advertising is pretty much locked in, distribution centers all locked in? What happened? Well, you know, and you look at some of the progress that they've made, sales per square foot has risen. It was about $114, $115 on a broader store base under a promotional environment. And it's risen to $116 a square foot, which is really impressive, particularly when you consider that they went from, you know, having like nine promotional events a quarter to none. SG&A has shrunk, you know, more than you'd be expected. It's gone from $360 million, you know, pre-COVID to $245 million, you know, significant savings. But it hasn't, gone down significantly as a percent of sales, because you know, sales obviously went down as the store base shrunk. Their operating efficiencies improved. Inventory turns have risen from, you know, full turn from 2.7x to 3.7x pre-COVID to, you know, trailing 12 months. So what are the headwinds? Well, you know, they've had increased transportation and labor costs. In their case, the transportation costs are not boats that are stuck off or ships that are stuck off the coast of California. It's really more in, you know, trucking transit costs, which is driven by fuel and labor shortages there. You know, certainly they have, they've had additional labor costs in that the they've raised some wages in the store and in the distribution center. They've also found that they've had to put additional labor units to work in the distribution center as they've shifted their buying. So essentially they're buying in bulk items that may need some rework before they can get sent onto the stores. And that's additional labor in the DC. And anecdotally, from their comments, sort of you're reading between the lines, that there's a good bit of work that needs to be done to optimize the distribution center that they have. And but again, you know, it's a question of what's your time horizon. If you are looking for the next quarter, you know, who knows? Probably not a fantastic stock. If you're looking further out, you can look beyond some of these near-term headwinds. Certainly the ending of pandemic relief payments, the child tax credit, it's going to lower household budgets this year. The Omicron spike in December, you know, may have impacted holiday sales. And then it came out today that retail sales were down just under 2% in December. So, you know, that's almost certainly to have had an adverse impact. And this is a fiscal year focused on optimizing distribution. You know, in fact, we may not have real clarity in the financials demonstrating the economic power of this business until early 2023. So it's a long-term, you know, it's a long-term thesis. It's not a quarter to quarter thesis. So the question is, you know, with all of that, why would you want to own the stock? You know, and here to go into to the transport supply chain issues. You know, before COVID, they were generating about $39 per square foot in gross profit on 114 square feet in revenues. For the trailing 12 months, they generated only $34 a square foot on $116 a square foot in revenues. So revenues have gone up, you know, in spite of shrinking the store base, in spite of going ending promotional activity. But, you know, they're generating less. And what really happened, and you can see it's you know, significant, if you annualize that impact, you know, negative $32 million in adverse gross profit on a $220 million enterprise value company is pretty significant. What really happened was things were going pretty well up until the June quarter. So even coming out, or even during COVID, they were able to maintain their gross margins at a pretty healthy rate. And then all of a sudden, you know, in the June quarter and then persisting into the September quarter of last year, you know, margins really took a hit. And I think it's, you know, in part because of the increase in transportation costs, implementing some changes in the distribution center, which are, and in their buying, which has caused some, you know, increased labor costs, but it's a recent phenomenon. And so, you know, the question is, why would you want to own this? Well, you know, EBITDA before rent was running about 14% pre-COVID and recovered to that level, you know, in December of 20, March of 21. It fell below 8% in the June and September quarters, again, because of the transport issues I just mentioned. You know, if this could rise just 2 percentage points, So 10%, still 4 percentage points below where they were, you know, in the March of 21 quarter. And they get, you know, some sales growth up to 750 million versus, you know, 706 million in the last 12 months, which is not a big stretch. You know, you're looking at $75 million of EBITDA. You know, comps like Ross or Burlington trade around 10 times. Tuesday Morning trades at 4 times. If you just take that multiple up to 8 times on that $75 million EBITDA, you have a $6 stock that's currently trading at, you know, $1.90. So there is significant upside potential. You know, that said, what else is there aside from it's a cheap stock that may turn around? Well, let's look at some of the incentives here. I've mentioned the caliber of the management team. But, you know, one of the things that caught my initial interest in this was I came across something I hadn't really seen before in their filings. So Osmium and Tensile have a, you know, special purpose vehicle that combined owns a little over 31% of the company. It looks like Osmium had a direct role in bringing the CEO Fred Hand into the company. And one of the incentives that they offered was to offer him 30% of their carried interest on that SPV. Now, you know, don't have the specific terms of the SPV available, but just, you know, taking a back of the envelope, you know, calculation, if you've got, let's say, 20% carried interest and you have 31% of the stock, and, you know, the CEO can get 30% of that, you know, you're capturing about just under 2% of the market cap over the strike, which is, you know, $2.88 was the strike price on this, which was, you know, the day that he was brought in. So, you know, for every dollar increase above 288, you know, it could be, you know, over $1.5 million in cash. Now, there's a vesting period and all that, but the incentives there are large. It's also notable that the performance stock units vest in three tranches for management at 6, 9, and 12. And if you back, if you reverse engineer to, you know, I've already showed what it would take to get over 6. To get to 9, to get to 12, you know, it's not hard to do. I'll leave the math to the audience, but essentially you need to start seeing some sales growth and you need to get, you know, the margin recovery. It doesn't take a lot to get there. And then the question is, you know, what's the downside? Now, you know, at the beginning or in the middle of this, I detailed you the stock price and how it collapsed when they pulled their, when they essentially pulled guidance in, you know, September, early September of last year. Well, what was management's action in response to that? Well, so on September 8th, the stock closed at 427. On the 9th, they released their earnings. The stock price falls 45% to 234. Over the course of the next week, it falls another 26% to $1.73. Well, what happens? Well, you know, in three tranches, the CEO buys about 1 million shares with his own money at prices between 165 and 181. The chief operating officer buys, you know, 150,000 shares at 171. The CIO buys 100,000. The chief marketing officer, Metcalf, buys, 100,000 shares. And Metcalf takes the opportunity to convert from a consultant to an employee so that he now gets the performance. He got a grant of performance options, your share units or whatnot, you know, granted to him, you know, with that as the base price. So, you know, they clearly, you know, this management team is seeing value here that is beyond the current quarter, beyond maybe the current year. They recognize, I imagine, that you know the relationship with the customer is not broken. Sales have been, sales have been good. It's just a question of these near-term margin pressures that I don't think they expected, but that ultimately, one way or the other, you have to assume it's transitory. I think right now they are they're afraid of raising prices, and frankly, you know, I don't blame them. You don't want to be, particularly if you are a smaller player compared to a Burlington, a Ross, a Home Goods, you don't want to be the first to raise your prices. That's the value proposition that's attracting your customers. But you would very quickly follow in the lead if Home Goods raises prices, if Ross or Burlington raises their prices. So these pressures are facing the industry. If you look at the performance of Ross and Burlington since August, it's not good. If you look at the performance of those companies since year to date, it's really not very good. Retail has sold off significantly, and for understandable short-term reasons. Fiscal stimulus appears to be all but over. Between the disaster relief funds, between the child tax credit that expired at the end of the year, we're left in a situation similar to in 2009, where it's going to be left to the Fed to manage the economy through monetary policy, because it doesn't appear that a whole lot's going to get through our Congress. But one way or the other, these pressures should be transitory. And if you navigate through that, you have a company that has a good relationship with their customer. Sales have not fallen off. It's not a broken turnaround story. It's a company that is experiencing short-term cost pressures and needs to sort that out. In addition, there are opportunities for upside that they haven't discussed. That may be available. Ross and Burlington do not have an online sales component. Home Goods does. A company that we had a position in before, At Home, which is more, durable household goods and furnishings, they developed an online strategy. And, it appears that you can, it's hard for companies like this that have so many SKUs, and those SKUs are changing, but certainly it insulates you that you can use your store base as a venue for, you can either offer pickup at the store with an expedited checkout, where you're essentially prepaying and the store just acts as fulfillment, or you can have it brought to your home. And of course it insulates you from things like, pandemic related shutdowns or just a consumer that maybe returning to work and doesn't have the time to go to the store. So there's certainly some upside there, but right now, if I look at ideas to present at this Best Ideas Conference, a best idea from my perspective is something where the absolute downside risk is perceived to be very very slight, limited. Risk of permanent capital impairment, and a clear sense of where a near-term floor might be, with the caveat being that in under a short time frame anything can happen, and combined with the potential to generate significant opportunity for capital appreciation. So it's that highly asymmetric presentation of reward to risk that is what constitutes a best idea for me. And so in summary, very limited downside and significant upside, the current quote, a proven and well-incented management team. It is, you know, it's a blocking and tackling story. It's execution. It's not strategy. It's not a turnaround. It's, you know, how do you get this cost spike? How do you get through that? Expectations have been significantly lowered, both for the company, and you're also now dealing with, you know, the industry, retail as a whole, is out of favor at the moment. So you have an unloved company and an unknown company in an unloved industry. And certainly on face value, you know, it's something, you know, that matches a pattern that I look for, with things that they don't screen well. They don't look good. The optics don't look good at first glance. But if you dig beneath the surface, you know, hopefully that, you know, that research effort is rewarded by finding something where the probable outcome is far, far more favorable than sort of the very, you know, quick consensus expectation view. And so that is the end of the presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions on this. And please, you know, if you want to reach out directly, the email's there. Happy to make the connections and discuss this or any other stock.
Chris, thank you so much for the presentation. Just a reminder to everyone on the line, if you have a question, please click the Q&A icon in Zoom and write in your questions. Maybe on capital allocation, looking forward, what would you like the priorities to be?
I think the first priority that they've indicated is, you know, it sounds like this distribution center in Dallas is not optimal for them. The near-term fix is probably to optimize it as much as they can. The long-term fix very well may be to start with a clean sheet of paper and generate a distribution model that is more, you know, appropriate to their needs. And I think that's their focus. They've said nothing about online. So I don't know if that's a focus for them. I would imagine at the moment it probably isn't. But just getting that distribution worked out so that they can get the costs in line. And you know, I should add with that, you know, the balance sheet's clean. You know, there's a little short-term debt that is seasonal as they, you know, build up inventory in the fall in advance of the winter, you know, holiday sales season. But other than that, it's a clean balance sheet. You know, the financial risk here is very limited.
Well, certainly seeing Osmium on there, for me at least, means something, because I have great respect for John Lewis. So I'm wondering, you know, kind of the dynamics that you see between the large shareholders and the management. You know, how closely are the large shareholders here involved in the day-to-day?
They have board representation. And, you know, as an aside, you know, back in the early 2000s, I was based in the Bay Area, and would go to, so one of the brokers had, you know, these hedge fund dinners, idea dinners, and John was present there. And, you know, he was just starting out and struck me as you know, a very thorough and very thoughtful investor. So, you know, certainly, you know, I haven't spoken to him. And Tensile, it's Richard Bloom's private and public equity heads, split off and form Tensile. So you've got some, you know, well-respected investors there. And, you know, I think them having board representation and having such a large shareholder ownership position, you know, I think what I tend to read into that is that the likelihood of you know, something stupid happening on the capital allocation side is pretty minimal. You know, as a funny aside, so I showed you the incentives where there's a side deal between Osmium and the CEO. And what's interesting about that is because Osmium is on the board and considered a related party, even though this is a side deal, the accounting is such that Tuesday Morning actually has to allocate on their income statement something for the for that agreement as an expense, even though they're not a party to it. So, you know, there's always something new in accounting to learn that I never thought I would ever see.
Well, that is strange because they're not expected to end up paying.
They're not paying it. Yeah. Tuesday Morning's not a party to it, but because they have board representation, they're considered a related party and the accountants, you know, make them put something in the bank. It's not much. It's like a couple hundred thousand. Well, it used to be a couple hundred thousand. Now the stock's been doing nothing but going down for the last few months. There shouldn't be, an expense there, but it's just another one of those things you see. You're like, well, yeah, did not see that one coming, but it's irrelevant to the thesis, of course.
Of course, Chris, you mentioned their bankruptcy was kind of strategic and had a clear purpose. What happened to the pre-bankruptcy equity holders?
If you were a pre-bankruptcy equity holder and you did not sell, you are still an equity holder. The equity was not canceled. It did change ticker. So depending on what financial terminal you're using, you might not get to see that because I believe the old ticker was TUES and then it went to TUESQ and then it came out. And it trades as TUEM. So like I'm using FactSet and there is no historical back beyond early 21 when it came back on, even though the equity was not canceled. There was a different hedge fund guy. I wasn't involved in the name during the bankruptcy. And so, you know, I haven't spent a lot of time getting up to date on it, but there was a hedge fund guy that was involved. I think he was CEO at the time. And, I think it was because of him that they decided to be so opportunistic in using Chapter 11 as a means of restructuring the footprint. And, you know, it's unclear to me that because there's so many moving pieces and because of COVID, it's very hard. I can't make the argument definitively that the stores that were closed were poorly performing stores because the average per store performance metrics, you know, did not change tremendously. Sales went up a bit, you know, profitability went up a bit. Obviously rent cost went down. Which leads me to the suspicion that it was not that you had, you know, a third of your stores were just dogs and the rest were great and you wanted to find a way to get rid of the dogs. My guess is that, and again, this is entirely, speculation on my part, but my guess is that what really happened was which stores could you negotiate with the landlords effectively? And so it was on the stores where you couldn't negotiate a significant rental decline. And you thought that store was, you know, not particularly exceptional. You might just close that even if it was a decently performing store. Because it gave you this opportunity. And again, you know, keep in mind, this is, you know, being decided late spring, early summer of 2020, when the world felt a lot different than it feels now. in some ways. And there was maybe more uncertainty about COVID. And so, you know, I think the way to look at that is that going forward, if you think about the path to get, you know, the path to get to six is just to get the costs, you know, back in line with where they were, you know, three quarters ago during COVID. It's not radical transformations. How do you tame this cost spike? The path to getting to 9 to 12, that involves sales growth. And so if you look at it and say, well, gee, they had, I don't know, like 700 stores, and they went down to just under 500. You know, there's an opportunity for them to re-enter the markets that they were in, or just add store growth once they get the distribution model figured out, once they get their costs in line. You know, there's a pretty clear path of saying, hey, what if we added another 50, 100, 150 stores over the next, you know, 5 years? You know, where can that, once you get the model done, where can that take you? So I think in a way they were really given this gift. And I think that's part of what attracted them to the opportunity. That's like, hey, you've got a shrunken store model. You've got a lot of the costs have already been operated, you know, taken out of the system. Certainly when they signed on, they didn't have the visibility, or I doubt they had the visibility that, oh, there's going to be, you know, a spike in operating costs, you know, almost immediately after taking over. And maybe some of those costs are actually being driven by the changes that they're making. So once they get those costs under control, the next step is, well, now how are you going to grow it? You know, and maybe that is more stores. Maybe that's investing in IT to have an online strategy so that you're, you know, better protected for, you know, the retail environment that we live in, and better protected, and, you know, you know, some of these, you know, shutdowns, although I don't think any of us think that we're going back into a world of shutdowns, hopefully. But there's, you know, it's kind of a, you know, there's a spring, you know, if you think of it as a spring, the spring is getting pushed, and it's coiling up. And, you know, I think there's a lot of latent potential in the business for getting it, operating more effectively and efficiently, and then a clear path towards growing it.
Okay, well, on that note, I think we'll wrap it up. I want to thank everyone for listening and participating. And Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us again this year and to present this investment thesis to the MOI Global community.
Great. Thank you, John. It's always a pleasure. Happy New Year to everybody.
Best wishes. Goodbye for now.
Thank you.